He was one of the greatest college football players ever to put on a uniform. A 6-tool player who could run, catch, pass, kick off, return kicks, and defend. Born and raised in Newport News, Virginia, he learned to play in the streets, dodging fire hydrants and street lamps. He excelled at every sport he played, whether it was football, basketball, baseball, or track. He could have had a scholarship in any of them, but chose football and chose Purdue thanks to a newly hired assistant coach who dared to cross the color line. Freshmen weren't eligible during his college career. The season was only 10 games long, and he played defense as a sophomore. Still, he managed to put up some incredible numbers. After the Boilermakers went to the Rose Bowl a sophomore year, he was switched mostly to offense as a junior and senior. He was the Big Ten's MVP and first-team All-American before he left Purdue, during which time he helped the Boilermakers to a 25-6 record. He was the first running back at Purdue to rush for more than 1,000 yards, and he's still the only Purdue player to have more than 100 yards rushing and receiving in the same game. And he did that twice. He's a member of the College Football Hall of Fame, the Rose Bowl Hall of Fame, and was voted the greatest player in Purdue's football history on the 100th anniversary of the program in 1987. There's really too much to talk about in one show, but let's see what we can squeeze in. I'm Mark Monteith, and I'm going one-on-one with Marvin Leroy Keyes.
This is One-on-One with Mark Monteith on 1070 The Fan. Brought to you by Georgetown Market, Indy's family-owned natural food store since 1973. Movie Time Video Productions, they make your memories last forever.
Well, today on One-on-One, we're making a house call in West Lafayette, Indiana, to Leroy Keyes. Our veteran listeners know the name Leroy Keyes awfully well. And Leroy, let's jump into this. You're born in Newport News, Virginia.
Yes.
There's some other athletes who have come from that area. Now, we're talking Michael Vick, Antoine Bethea, Mike Tomlin. Who am I leaving out here?
Well, you're leaving out a whole bunch. I mean, when you talk about that area, you're talking about Norm Snead. You're talking about Chris Hamburg. You're talking about Frankie Emanuel. You're talking about Earl Faison, Benny McCray. You're talking about Donnie Green, John Bullock, Plaxico Burress, Kenny Easley, just to name a few. Roger Brown back in the day, and Lawrence Taylor, who was from up near Williamsburg, Virginia. Also, we claim him as one of our own. So, great town. And then I can't leave our AI. I have to bring AI.
Allen Iverson, area, right?
Great basketball player and also a football player.
Yes, he was a great football player. He could have played major college football. Yes, I would imagine. What is it about that area that produces athletes? Then anything?
I just think it's a little about people who care about you. I mean, you know, your high school coaches care about you. The administration at your schools care about, at your high schools care about you. And it's a community activity. Everybody wants to come out and support you. So knowing that you have all this support and this background, it makes it easier to go out and just want to do well. And the competition is so great. I call that area a hidden treasure.
Yeah, well, you used to play in the streets, right?
Oh,
football in the streets.
That's where it started. I mean, you know, it started in the streets, and if you could avoid the fire hydrants and avoid tripping up on the sidewalks and missing the ditches and not killing your dog walking down the street or any senior citizen out, yes, we played a lot of ball in the streets, two-hand tag. Nothing to hurt each other, but then on Saturdays, we knew we were going to get a chance to not put on any helmets or anything, but we played rough touch, which was a little tougher than just two-hand tag. It was, I'm going to let you know I'm out here on the field. And if you had speed, you didn't have to worry about it. And if you had any kind of footwork, you were okay. And we played that was our training grounds for all purposes. And then once we got out on the football field, it was like, you got to be kidding me. Yeah. I got 50 yards wide and 100 yards long. I mean, guys, some of y'all won't even see or touch me in this kind of environment.
Okay. Now, what did your dad do there?
Well, my father, I didn't really get to know my father that often. I would say I was raised by the family. My uncle, mm-hmm. Arthur, was very instrumental in my life. And my mother, Doris, she did a yeoman's job of serving as the second in charge in the house because I had a grandmother who matriotic in the house. Granny did everything. I mean, it went through her first, and then it dwindled on down to the kids in the family. So, but far as having actual contact, I do know that my father is living in New York City, but we have no relationship whatsoever.
Really? Have you ever met him?
I've met him on several occasions, but, you know, it wasn't something that you really wanted to hang your hat on because mm-hmm. it was an awkward transition. Here I was in my mid-30s, and I hadn't seen him ever, and my mom came over to me when she was still living and said, "That's your dad right there." And I went over to introduce myself to him, and he looked at me like, "Oh, you're a big guy. I mean, I can't do the things to you I used to do when you were younger." And I'm kind of saying, I'm waiting for a hug or, "Hey, yeah, how you doing?" or something. But it was nothing of that nature. So I didn't know anything about his background, his family, or anything. So it was hard for me to just say, well, maybe, just maybe dad just don't know. And so I just say, if that's the way you're going to handle it. But my mother had remarried during that time, and I looked over and saw my stepfather, and I said, "That's the man I know."
Yeah. So what did they do for work? You know, how did they support?
Well, my mother, she worked at a school. She worked custodial work at Sedgefield Elementary School. And my stepfather worked in the construction business. He worked from Virginia to D.C. to New Jersey, and eventually he ended up in New York City, where he fell in love with New York, and he just did what we want to call him a rigger or concrete layer or whatever, but they did domestic work, but they both enjoyed what they did.
So your name is Marvin Leroy Keyes.
Marvin Leroy.
Why do you go by the middle name?
Well, you know, when I was in school, I had an aunt who was in charge of our glee club, and we had a young lady in the glee club. Her name was Mavis, and I didn't want anybody to know my name was Marvin because it was too close to Mavis. So when she called me, I wouldn't say a word. And so she finally just said, "Marvin, don't let me call you out." And everybody's kind of looking like, who's up your name, Marvin? Yeah. You know. So I finally said, "Okay." She said, "So," but I said, when I got into college, I said, "I think I'm gonna change my name to Leroy because the name sounds a little more like a athlete than Marvin." You know, I've heard a couple of Marvin, but not many. So I said, "I don't want to be the first Marvin out there on the market."
Okay. Yeah, Leroy's more distinctive.
Yeah, more distinctive.
No doubt about it. So you began organized sports, I'm sure, at a young age. You're an incredible high school athlete. You played football, basketball, baseball, right?
Loved them all.
Yeah. Loved basketball, did I read you average like 27 points a game as a senior or something like
that? Could have been better, but the bottom line is, you know, when you're trying to win the state championship or you're trying to win your division championship or conference, you got to have everybody involved. And we had such great players on my squad. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to play with some guys who were just magnificent basketball players.
Could you have played major college basketball? Did you get scholarship offers?
Yeah, I got a couple. But, you know, once football season was over, I had to make a determination. And I said, "Well, Leroy, which way do you want to go? Do you want to go basketball? Do you want to go football? Or do you want to go track and field?" And I said, "Well, I'm really not that fast. I wasn't going to scare John Carlos or Tommy Smith off the track. But I said, football, I think I can do that. And if I want to play basketball," I think Coach Molikoff had left it open to say, "Well, if you want to play basketball, we'll leave it open to you." But once I got in college and we didn't have that freshman year we could play, so you had that as your redshirt year. And I was more concerned with the fact of, can I stay eligible due to schoolwork to get out of here in 4 years? Because I didn't want to be in college for 5 years or 6 years. I wanted to graduate with my class that I came in with. So I made the decision, and I think the decision was made. We played we had about 10 guys on the football team who could play basketball pretty decently, and we dominated the co-rec here on campus. And we were playing against Rick Mount and that freshman team they had in, and I had a fast break, 2-on-1 fast break, and had a young guy named Tyrone Bedford who had recruited out of Louisville, Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And I went to make a behind-the-back pass, fake, pull it back, and shoot a layup. And Tyrone, open palm, hit me. And I was wearing glasses at the time, and the glass shattered, and glass was all around my eye. And I went to do this, and Tyrone grabbed my arm. When Coach Molikoff and Red Mackey saw that, they said that was the end of my basketball career. They said, "Leroy, we love you. We want you to enjoy your collegiate career. It's football now."
Yeah.
So I turned to football and finished up in football.
Let's go back in high school. Okay. You ran track. What events in track?
Well, I was a long jumper, basically. That was my specialty. I was
and you state, went 24 feet, right?
I went 24, 4.5 in high school, and I went 26.2 in a dual meetup in Baltimore one summer. But I ran on most of the relay teams. I didn't want to specialize in 100-yard dash because I saw too much speed in my hometown. But I ran on most of the relays. I ran all the way up to the quarter-mile relay. And if coach needed a point in track, in the hurdles, I go run the hurdles, 220 lows or 110s. And but that was track. I just love going down the runway, hitting the board, and just see how far I can go, hang in the air.
From what I've read, you know, you're about 6'3". You averaged about 27 and a half points of basketball. You hit almost 300 as a shortstop in baseball. You're 24-4 as a broad jumper, which I guess still stands as a state record.
Somebody came along and broke it a couple of years later.
Okay,
but you know it stood as a Virginia record. And let me I had to explain and break it down. Being out of the South at that time, there was different situations. I went to an all-black high school. Mm-hmm. We never played against any of the white high schools in the state of Virginia because of segregation and other things that were in our way. But in my division, which was known as the VIA, which was the Virginia Interscholastic Association, versus the VSHL, which is the Virginia High School League that catered to the other side. Uh-huh. And we had competition, but our competition against the other schools were in summer league basketball or summer league baseball. And it was one of those things that you kind of look back and said, okay, my senior year, as you stated, I averaged almost 27, 28 points a game, almost double digit, triple doubles was something we were doing back then, but nobody was keeping the records.
Yeah.
And then we had a kid named Chris Keller who went to Newport News High School. And he averaged like 14 points a game, maybe 5 rebounds a game. He made 13th parade All-American. And I went ballistic. I went like, how does this guy here make 13? I averaged 29 points. I didn't even get an honorable mention, nothing. But it was because we weren't getting the type of ink back then.
So he was white, right?
He was white. I was black.
And you were only competing against other black schools?
Right. Okay. Right.
Keys winds up at Purdue thanks to the efforts of an assistant coach and Southern prejudice when One-on-One continues. But first, here's Keys during an interview on Purdue's golf course following his college career. He happened to be a better-than-average golfer, too, adapting quickly to that game like all the others he played.
The Purdue Boilermakers have a lot of things going for them. The world's largest drum, the Golden Girl. But the greatest thing they've had for the last 3 years is a football jack-of-all-trades named Leroy Keys. Leroy runs with the ball in an exciting loose-legged style. He catches passes. And he throws them. Leroy also likes to play golf on the course at Purdue and philosophize about football.
Well, I was reaching for the streak. Not too bad.
He explains how it is when you run with the ball.
Sometimes you can just read the blockers. If the blockers are doing the job up front, this make the back job more easier. We just follow their blocks and hope we can run hard enough to evade a couple of people.
Leroy's balance, ability to change speeds and directions, and keep going long after others would have been knocked off their feet, make him a dangerous man with a football.
Welcome back to One-on-One. Mark Monteith here with former Purdue All-American Leroy Keys. His choice of colleges was limited coming out of high school because Southern schools weren't yet recruiting black athletes. But a newly hired assistant coach swept in and got him for Purdue.
Tell me about recruiting. How do you wind up at Purdue? And now I know a lot of Southern schools were not recruiting black athletes. We're talking, what, 1965?
65. And you're coming out really of high school. None. Yeah. Basically, I was really headed to North Carolina A&T. I had my uncle knew he went to A&T, graduated, and he knew Mr. Green, who was the recruiter for A&T. And I said, I'm going to A&T because A&T had decided to offer me a brand new 1965 car, all the clothes I wanted.
Hey.
And the school sat right across from an all-girls school. I said, that's great. Can't beat that.
Perfect.
But I had an English teacher by the name of Miss Marie Holland, and when I told her I was thinking about going to A&T, she told me, she said, well, I'll see you again and I'll see you back here next year. And I'm looking at her like, what do you mean? I'm ready to graduate. She said, Leroy, she said, I'm going to tell you this. If you decide to take A&T over Purdue University or one of these other schools that offer you, I'll flunk you. And I'm looking at her like, you got to be kidding me. She said, try me. And I figured she was serious. I said, so when Purdue sent Bernie Miller down to recruit me. Bernie Miller was working for Iowa State at the time as the defensive secondary coach. Purdue hired him while he was on the road, so they gave him the Tidewater area because he was from Portsmouth, Virginia.
Okay.
So Bernie comes down, and sight unseen, Bernie Miller came to my high school, and we had a basketball game because he never saw me play football. So he came to a basketball game. We were playing basketball, and the team, both teams come out into the gymnasium to warm up, and both teams kind of stopped, and they looked up in the stands. We had never seen a white person in our audience watching us play.
Yeah.
Ever. And we were like, this guy got to be lost. There's nowhere in the world this guy is sitting in this gymnasium by himself. Well, he sat there and he watched the game, and then he went out. And Bernie talked to all of the coaches in my conference, all of them. He went to each school and said, do you think this kid is Big Ten material? Do you think he could play at the Big Ten level? And, you know, not knowing who is watching or observing what you do, I didn't know what the other coaches were thinking about Leroy Keyes. Mm-hmm. But to a man, I want to say, if Keyes can't play in the Big Ten, there's nobody in this conference that can play in the Big Ten. So that was like a compliment that I didn't know I was even warranted of, but yet they said it. And so when Purdue invited me out to see the campus for my official visit, I came out here with all kind of doubts. You know, I kept telling myself, you know, the two big – well, it was three guys that I knew who had come into the Big Ten and been successful. Earl Faison, who went to Indiana, ended up with the San Diego Chargers. He was from Huntington High School, and he had a successful career in Indiana. And Benny McCray, who was a hurdler and also a defensive back, played with the Chicago Bears in the NFL, and Benny went to Michigan. And then I had another guy named Daniel Grimes from my high school who also went to Michigan. And when they came back, they told you, hey, great move. You know, we can't go south. So if you're not going to Syracuse, if you're not going to Penn State, if you're not going to NYU, if you're not going to any of the schools up north, Big Ten is the next location unless you go to California. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you talk about Jackie Robinson and all the ball players coming out of UCLA and USC, it was a different world on the West Coast versus the schools in between, because you still were looking at Arkansas, Oklahoma, and those schools. They still relatively were not recruiting black athletes.
Right.
And so now I had someone who I could trust. So after I came out to Purdue, saw the campus, and fell in love with the fact that they had an airport on campus. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. These people got an airport on campus. Can't beat
and that
this.
Was the first time you'd ever flown, right?
First time I ever flown, scared to death. But for some reason, that Lake Central airline, that plane got me to and from. And when I went back home and talked to my coaches, and they said, well, Leroy, look, you know, there's a possibility that Army and Navy were after me, but I didn't want to go military. Notre Dame, they sent a letter, but nobody followed up. So I got a basketball scholarship for NYU, track scholarship from New Mexico State. And I said to myself, I said, now, I had an opportunity to look at UCLA for basketball, but that was the year they were recruiting Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Yeah.
And I said, well, you know, do I really want to go that far? And I was halfway scared just to fly to Indiana. I can imagine flying on a prop plane all the way from Virginia to California. Yeah. I said, no way.
Yeah.
And so it was one of those things where you had to make a gut decision. I sat down and talked to my mom, my uncles, and they said, Leroy, look, quality education. They got a good program. You're going to get your degree if you stay focused on what you're there for. It's not about the football. Mm-hmm. If you play good football, that's fine. But we want you to get your degree from Purdue University because that's going to take you further than the fact that you play football someday. And so I kind of took it in stride and said, okay, we'll see what happens. And when I got out here, it was just love at first sight. And the person who was the catalyst, really, behind my coming to Purdue was Marv Levy. Now, Marv Levy was the head coach at William & Mary, mm-hmm. which was only 16 miles from where I lived. Mm-hmm. But Marv Levy was the one who initially called Bernie Miller and said, Bernie, we got a kid down here who can flat out play, but we can't touch him. And I'm not ready. And I don't think anybody in the state of Virginia is ready to make that leap.
Didn't want to break the color line.
They didn't want to break the color line. And yeah. I mean, you know, Virginia Tech was close by, VMI, you name them. All the schools are close by, but they said, no way. So when I got here, I just found a bunch of guys who just wanted to win. And that was the key. Jack just said, okay, guys, here's as long as you're not telling me a lie or giving me a lot of baloney and you can play the game, I'll play you. But if I find out you're lying and not doing what I want you to do in the classroom, I'll get rid of you. And Jack was an honest coach, and I think we all bought into it.
Yeah. Your sophomore year, as you said, you're not eligible as a freshman
right.
At Purdue. But your sophomore year, we're talking, I guess, the fall of 1966, you're a defensive back.
Yes.
You came. When you were recruited, did they recruit you to a position, or did they just say, we'll play wherever you can play?
I think more than likely, I think, They probably use that old word that I sort of hate, athlete.
Athlete, yeah.
You know, it tells you, well, he can play here, he can play there, he can do this, he can do that. But then again, you always tried because a lot of times coaches, when they don't know you and they don't have any footage, any film to evaluate anything on, they're taking the word of some coaches they don't know. They're taking the word of a brand new coach who just came in, and they said, "Bernie, come on, this kid can't play. He can't do this. He can't do that." So now it's the proving ground time. So my sophomore year, I think Bob DeMoss was the offensive coordinator, and I forget, I think Ned Malone may have been the defensive coordinator. And they said, "Well, hey, Bernie, since you're the defensive secondary coach, you take him over there with you."
That casual, huh?
Yeah.
Well, you had three interceptions that year as a defensive back. Purdue finished 8-2, losing only to Notre Dame and Michigan State, who had tied for the national championship. And then, but the first time you touch a ball, though, right, you return a fumble for 94 yards on national television against Notre Dame.
That was a total enigma. That was so uncanny. First of all, we go up to South Bend, and we had another cornerback named Dennis Serbes. Dennis is a little, about 5'9", 5'10", white kid. Here I am, 6'3", 208 pounds. And we're on the sideline. We've just gone through the warm-up. We go to the sideline, and they had the ball. And we got 10 guys on the field. So Dennis looks at me, and he said, "You go in." I said, "No, you go in." I could see the Coach Miller didn't tell either one of us to go in. Uh-huh. So Dennis just, "Man, you're going on the field." So I ran on the field.
From 8 yards out, Hanratty pitches to Rocky Blyer. The junior halfback can't hold on and fumbles. Purdue's Leroy Keyes grabs the ball and is off and running. There's going to be no stopping Keyes as he charges all alone for a 94-yard touchdown. The Boilermakers jolt the Irish early, 7-0.
And I said, "Wow, what luck." I knew, but I found out I had that one fumble recovery. I had 11 tackles during the course of the game. So I figured, hey, I was doing something right. But during the same course of the game, Jim Seymour and Terry Hanratty was killing us on the left side.
Yeah.
And the guy I'm guarding, Nick Eddy, doesn't even run pass routes. He's a running back coming out as a wide receiver. And he doesn't run any pass routes. So I'm over here with a guy who's not, they're not throwing the ball to him at all.
Yeah, it's easy.
And so I said, well, it was an easy day. It was. But then the following week, we came home, we played SMU. And they had a kid by the name of Jerry Levias. And Jerry Levias could flat out fly. So Jack decided, and Bernie concurred, to say, we're going to let Leroy flop with their best receiver. So my job the rest of that season was wherever the most dangerous receiver for the opposing team was, that's where I went. So I got Jerry Levias in the SMU game. I got Gene Washington from Michigan State. When we played them, I got Jack Clancy from Michigan. So wherever the best receiver was, that's where I was going.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed it.
Purdue gets the only Rose Bowl win in school history when One-on-One continues. Back on One-on-One, Mark Monteith here with former Purdue All-American Leroy Keyes. He played defensive back most of his sophomore season, but still found ways to score. In fact, he scored a touchdown on national television, no less, the very first time he touched the ball that season, which wound up with the Boilermakers playing in Pasadena. Purdue goes to the Rose Bowl, though, your sophomore year, because you're runner-up in the Big Ten, but Michigan State had gone the year before.
Right.
And the Big Ten had a rule then that no team could go 2 years in a row,
which
is kind of crazy when you think about it. But your sophomore year, you guys go to the Rose Bowl to play USC, and you win the game 14-13. George Katavalis has an interception in the end zone. Right?
We were very fortunate. He saved our cookies that day. We just knew John McKay was going to go for the win. We knew that USC felt they were a better team than Purdue. It's sort of reminiscent of the Purdue game against Kansas State a couple of years back when Joe Tiller came on board and Snyder, the coach of K-State, was upset that how are we the number ranked, three ranked team in the nation playing a team that's not even in the top 20?
Yeah.
And we went down there and beat them down in the bowl game, and we just upset their apple cart. And this was the same thing. USC – Purdue? What is a Purdue? I mean, we didn't have a state title in front of our name. We weren't Indiana. We weren't Michigan, Ohio State. We were Purdue. And it was one of those things where they knew they had to come out and play us. But I think USC kind of took us for granted. And it was a tight game, a well-played game between both teams. But, you know, George stepped up, made the interception on that 2-point conversion and got us out of there. And I tell you what, happy days. You know, it's a great thing to be on an airplane where you know you can smile, laugh, and everybody is talking, as opposed to glum sitting on the plane all the way home. That 2,200 miles or whatever the distance from Lafayette to Southern California could have been miserable, but George gave us a happy smile.
Had a nice trip home. A great trip. A lot of people waiting for you at the airport, probably.
Right? And you know, we at that moment, all we're thinking about is Grant. We're going back because we got just about everybody coming back. Yes. We got Mike Phipps going to be stepping in for Bob Greasy the following year. I mean, we knew we couldn't go back the following year, but we figured, hey, the year after, we still got Phipps again. He's a junior now, and I'm a senior. Perry Williams is running great. The defense is clicking. We're going to wrap this thing up. Lo and behold.
Didn't quite work out
no,
that way.
No, we put too many obstacles in front of us.
Yeah, must have been just fun. I mean, you're playing the Rose Bowl then was the game. You're playing on national television. I'm sure all your friends and family back home were able to see you play. Yeah. It must have just been a huge moment.
Oh, it was. I mean, you know, it's one of those things that was – I'm going to say it like this, Mark. The thing that kind of threw me off was when you're from Virginia, you see this on TV. But back as a little young kid in Virginia, you're not thinking Pasadena. You're thinking, gee whiz, if Hampton University is playing well today, I hope I can get to go to see watch Hampton or Norfolk State or Virginia State play. Because I knew those were my territories.
Yeah.
My vision were Heisman Trophy. What's the Heisman Trophy? It was something that you read about, but you didn't really think you were going to win this award. Going to Pasadena, you said, wait a minute. Little kid from Newport News, Virginia, Tidewater, going to Purdue, then going to California, representing his team. The first time Purdue ever had a team to go to Pasadena, California, and participate, not just go to watch, but to play in it. It was mind-boggling. It was like, wow, what have we done? And then we look at Michigan State and say, thank you, guys, because we didn't know what the rules were. Yeah. Nobody came out and told us, well, Michigan State can't go back. But once Jack said, we have qualified to represent the Big Ten and the Rose Bowl, it was like, we are going to go to Pasadena, California. And once you got there, I mean, you hit it right
on the whole nother world, huh?
I mean, when you say Sunset Strip, I mean, you talk about downtown and you're living in West Lafayette and the tallest building is City Hall. And out there, everything is glistening.
Yeah.
I mean, the parade, I mean, we didn't get to see the parade, but just when we saw it as a young kid, you see, coming around the bend. I mean, it's something that you just dream of, but you never think you're going to be a part of it.
Yeah.
And now for us to be the first team that Purdue ever had in its illustrious history, going all the way back to 1892.
Yeah.
Here we are. We represent Purdue after all these years. We thought we it was sweet.
Yeah.
It was too sweet.
Yeah. Yeah.
And far as the people at home, I mean, my grandmother ended up convincing my uncle that she needed a color TV because I want to see my baby in color. That's the first time we had a color TV in the house. So, yeah, it helped me, but it also helped somebody else in the family.
Yeah. So your junior year, you run the ball now.
You averaged
6.6 yards a carry, rush for almost 1,000 yards, over 1,800 all-purpose yards. You're the Big Ten most valuable player, 13 touchdowns. You go in, though, to the last game of the season at IU in a three-way tie for the Big Ten lead with Minnesota, Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
And this is probably the most famous bucket game. Not a happy memory for you, though, but Indiana winds up winning at 19-14 in Bloomington. You guys had a bunch of turnovers, but you were hurt, right?
Yeah. I think Coach Molikoff recognized the fact that I had a hip pointer, and he said, well, you know, we're not going to ruin your career in this one game. You're just valuable as a decoy, if that word is true. You go out flat wide, maybe you take two guys out there with you, and maybe we can run this play to Perry up the middle or Jimmy Kirkpatrick or Bob Barzell. And we went down there with the intent saying we're not going to lose to IU. First of all, we didn't want to lose the bucket. That play will always stand out because we got into what we call a hurry-up mode. Instead of calling a timeout and making sure we had the right personnel on the field, we had the starting center went out, and we got a backup guard come in, and he's supposed to be blocking down, and he blocks out. And the linebacker I think the same time Perry went to get the ball from Mike, the ball goes straight up in the air, and you're like frozen in time. But it was one of the things that part of the football. I mean, you know, and It's not that we lost. It was just the fact that we felt that we shouldn't have lost. It shouldn't have even gone down, the game being that tight. Mm-hmm. But giving credit to John Pond and his Chargers that year, they came out fired up. They were at home, and they were playing for something just as special as we were playing for the year before.
Yeah, you were ranked third in the country at the end of that game. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And even though you had that hip pointer, you rushed for 112 yards.
What? So you know, sometimes in life you get caught up on that adrenaline trail. Yeah. You know, you see your young child or someone hurt, that object that you're trying to move, it's going to be moved.
Yeah.
And I think at that moment, it was an urgency. Don't want to lose. Don't want to lose down here in Bloomington. Don't want to lose the IU. But the bottom line is you just went out and you just say, I'm going to do the things I can, and hopefully we can still come out on the victorious side. But on that day, they had our number.
Yeah. Well, going to your senior year, you guys are once again bowl eligible. Mm-hmm. You're preseason number one. You're on the cover of Sports Illustrated. Do you have that issue anywhere around here?
I have several around here. I mean, somebody sent me one almost every other week. I was going through a bookstore and I found this book I thought you might like, and I think I have about six. But what I found out that so many friends I had who didn't have it, and they would call me and say, I didn't know you were on the cover of Sports Illustrated. I said, I'll send you one.
Yeah, still, that had to be a huge thrill at the time.
It was. I mean, you know, I think Rick Mount, when he was a senior in high school at Lebanon High School, was on the front of Sports Illustrated.
Yep.
And I never thought I would end up on the cover of anything. But, you know, when to see it, it was like, you got to be kidding me. And it was special because it was that at that moment, we were, like you said, we were ranked number one in the nation. And come out, we knew we had a sharp quarterback in Mike Phipps. We knew he had the defense. We had all the elements. It was just that we forgot one thing. I think we thought we were invincible.
Yeah.
And that was it. We forgot that these other teams are not just going to come out on the field and hand you guys a win. You got to play.
Yeah.
And we did.
Purdue plays Notre Dame for number one, and Keyes bids for the Heisman Trophy when One-on-One continues. But first, here's Keyes showing what made him an All-American in a game against Iowa.
On the next play, Keyes takes a keeper pitch and skirts right in for 8 yards. Three plays later, keeper again pitches to Keyes, who cuts inside right end, finds daylight, and goes all the way down the sidelines for a 51-yard touchdown run.
Back on One-on-One, Mark Monteith here with Leroy Keyes, the former Purdue All-American. He was on the cover of Sports Illustrated while at Purdue, and the Boilermaker spent some time in the number one spot in the national rankings. One of its most memorable games came as a senior at Notre Dame, when the two teams played for the top ranking, and he showed off his versatility. You had a nationally televised game against Notre Dame that year,
right.
Your senior year. They called it the Pole Bowl because it was for the winner was going to be number one in the
number
country,
one country, right?
Right at Notre Dame, and you guys dominated them. You led 23-7 at the half. You almost had an interception that fell out of your hands that would have made it 30-7. You probably would have scored on it. You had a 16-yard touchdown run in that game, and you threw a 17-yard touchdown pass. And I've seen it on YouTube. You're rolling to your left, and you loft a perfect pass into the end zone for a touchdown. I mean, it looked like you could have been a quarterback in that play.
For the first and 10 on the Notre Dame 17-yard line, Leroy Keyes starts to sweep left, then passes into the corner of the end zone where Bob Dillingham hauls it in for another Purdue score. That gave Purdue a 17-7 lead in the second quarter.
Well, you know, the strange thing about quarterback in high school, so, you know, but when you try to convince someone else what you can do, it's a hard sell sometimes. I used to tell Bob DeMoss, who was the offensive coordinator, I said, Coach, I can do that. Well, Bob DeMoss was a quarterback himself, and he had recruited Bob Greasy, and he recruited Mike Phipps out of Columbus. And he would tell me, he said, just lob it out there. And I said, Coach, I know how to throw a football. But it was always this thing in Bob's mind that you're going to mess up this play. And I said, Coach, I can throw the ball. And Bob Dillingham, who was our split end at the time, Jim Byrne was the other flanker, but when Jim graduated, Dillingham became in. And I told him, I said, Dilly, if you sell the fake, if you sell that crackback in there on that safety, I'm going to put it right in that corner for you. And so, but Coach DeMoss would always say, just lob it, Marvin, just lob it. And I said, Coach, I got it. Sell it. You got to sell it. You got to make it look like a run. I said, Coach, I got it. We've run this play before. And sometimes, you know, your coaches just get kind of caught up in their moments too, because Jack is looking at his win and loss record. They want to hang Jack in effigy 1 year. I mean, he's a team that's 8-2, 8-2, 8-2, three consecutive years, and they want to hang the head coach.
Really, even during that run?
Oh yeah. Oh, in Ross State Stadium, they had Jack here hanging on a rope. Hang Fat Jack. Fat Jack must go.
And it, and as a team, that tells you how spoiled fans can get.
We're sitting there going, like, are you guys crazy?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not too many teams in the country that can beat us. I mean, we had a 10-game schedule, but it's not too many teams that can beat us. And you guys want to fire the coach?
This must have been after a loss or something, when you lost to Indiana fans, or when you lost to somebody
else. We were playing bad against Wake Forest. Mm-hmm. And if they want to hang anybody, they should have hung me that game. I mean, I think I fumbled the ball four times in the game and still ended up with four touchdowns, and we still won the game. Yeah. But it was one of those ugly games that I'd fumble, score. And then you look over on the opposite side of the field, our fans with Fat Jack must go, hang Coach Mollenkopf. And I'm going, so, you know, as a player, you get in the locker room, what was all that about?
Yeah.
So you can't go on campus the next week as a football player and want to beat up all the students for their stupidity. So you just go, like, you got to be kidding. But everybody had their opinion, and I guess they thought we should have been either 10-0, 10-0, and 10-0.
Yeah.
And but we just could never get off those two losses.
Well, the crucial game your senior year was at Ohio State. You had handled them 41-6 as a junior. You go into Columbus. You're ranked first in the country. And Woody Hayes, apparently, he had been preparing for Purdue for like weeks. He didn't prepare for the team they were playing. He prepared for Purdue every week, and their defense just had a great game that
day. They had some ball players.
13-0, I think. Was
13-0, but it was one of those games where it could have gone either way, and it was another one of those games where I went up in and that I was not able to play. I couldn't bend over and touch my shoes. I couldn't tie my shoes. I couldn't bend over. My back was gone. And they had Jack Tatum, who they were rating as the best football player in the world. They had Mike Sansonball. They had Rex Kern. Yeah. I mean, they had some ball players. Mm-hmm. It's Jim Snodecki. They had some ball players. And we went in there with the idea that, hey, this is going to be a great game. But quite naturally, what you stated earlier was so true. After the shellacking we put on them, going back to Ohio State 2 years in a row, we knew. Woody Hayes, after the shellacking we put on them, they started practicing that night after that game. They said this would never happen in our stadium again. And I think we went in there looking at our ratings more than looking at what we had to accomplish.
Yeah.
And so I couldn't run any pass routes. I couldn't block. I couldn't do anything. I was basically a decoy. And Rex Kern, I mean, they had a good running attack. When they say Woody Hayes 3 yards in a cloud of dust, that's exactly what they did. Big Jim Otis was up the middle. And they, once they got the lead, they just said defensively, go out and stop them. Mike, Dillingham, myself. Dillingham was getting open, but I couldn't do anything that game. I was done.
Yeah. Well, they went on. They won the Rose Bowl. They won the national championship. But at least your senior year, when you played IU, you got a little bit of revenge. You rushed for 140 yards. You caught passes for 149 yards. You know, so 289 yards, you know, was the best in school history before Otis Armstrong came along. But you're the only Purdue player ever to have 100 yards rushing and receiving in the same game. So that was quite a deal. You know, you finished second in the Heisman voting that year as well, your senior year to O.J. Simpson. I'm curious, then, it wasn't a TV production like now, so how did you find out about voting?
Well, see, the thing that was so strange about the Heisman, and to even today, I kind of look back on it and think that the Heisman was a jinx, and it wasn't really something that Purdue believed in. Although they had Bob Greasy, who was in the bidding the year Steve Spurrier won it. But what happened was Purdue came out and flat out told me, we're not going to do any advertising on your behalf for this Heisman Trophy. If you win it, it's going to be because of what you do on the field. Because we're not going to do no mass sending out letters and pictures and calling people and say, vote for Leroy. The Heisman Trophy to me is always a misnomer, because I don't really think it goes to the best athlete. I think it goes to the most popular athlete.
So what made you effective? Did you have great four, like what was your 40 speed? Did you ever check it or what?
4.4.
You're 4.4?
4.4.
And I know you were certainly agile. You were a great cutback runner. You found the holes.
That's what the beauty of it. I always thought that the guys were either running too fast or they were too overzealous and said, we're going to kill this guy. And I said, okay, you utilize his strength as his weakness. If he's coming in this way and he's running full board to try to pin you in, all you got to do is just stop. He's going to shoot on by. And if you got any kind of footwork, you just take a step to the left, and he's going that way, you going the other way.
Yeah.
And I relied a lot on that. And I think I would say I wore glasses, so I didn't have the greatest vision, but I knew I had football awareness. I knew somewhere this guy's going to run by me.
You had instincts.
I had instincts, and I just utilized those to my advantage because I could get away from the guys when I didn't want to get caught. But the bottom line is, I just said, if this guy's going to put his head down, he can't see me with his head down.
Yeah.
And so I just used instinct and just relayed that to do the best I could.
What made Mollenkopf successful, other than being able to recruit talent?
Honesty.
Yeah.
He was honest. Jack, Jack didn't mince words. If Jack said it's so, it was so. If Jack said, if you don't do this, I will bury you, he meant it. If Jack said, if you do it this way, we'll be successful. You go to class and take care of business and keep me informed of what you're doing, we'll have a happy, happy, happy ending. And we believed him. If Jack Mollenkopf raised his voice, it wasn't because he was angry at you. It was because he loved you that much that he said, I'm only doing this because I want to be a father figure to you. I know half of you guys right here don't even know who your father is. I'm going to be that father figure for you. I would go to bat for you if you're right, but if you're wrong, I will run you out of West Lafayette on the first, not plane, on the first bus leaving. And he meant it. And
yeah. And
you could see it in his passion on the sideline. He would get nervous. He'd get frustrated. He'd get frustrated. But yet he never once lost that look of, don't worry, we got it under control. We may be losing today, but you're going to learn a lesson from this loss.
Yeah.
And that was Jack Mollenkopf to me. He was so honest.
Did he go to bat for you at times?
Oh,
did he have to on campus?
I tell you, this was one of the incidents that I still stick out of my mind like it was yesterday. We had a place right down by the Armory. It was a little restaurant that the players went to or the people on campus went to get tenderloin sandwiches. That was the big thing back in the day. And so Perry Williams, Clan King, Marion Griffin, and myself, we lived at Owen Hall, and we were walking down how to correct pass before they start putting all these new stuff on campus, eating places. And we were going down to just get something to eat. And the two girls, it was two white girls on the other side of the street, and they start screaming. So we were like, what's wrong with them crazy people? So we kept walking. So we get down to the place and we walk in, we sit at get a booth. And all of a sudden, these red and blue lights start flashing. So we're like, oh, what's this? Car stop outside the eatery that we're in. And this police officer come in, and he walks straight to our table. Now, we're looking around in the restaurant. The place is not full, but let's say 25 people in the place. And he walks over to our table and said, okay, I want all four of y'all outside right now. And now, this is where my background from Virginia kicked in. I said, I'm not going anywhere. And so Perry and Clanton said, oh, Lord, Lee, we're going to get us in trouble. I said, hey, guys, if y'all want to go outside with the officers, y'all go. But I'm not going out there because he ain't asking nobody else in here to go outside, so I ain't going nowhere. So I sat down, and he said, oh, so you're a smart aleck, huh? I said, officer, I'm not smart, but I said, I didn't do anything, and I'm sitting here waiting on my food, and I'm not going outside. Well, he got on his phone and called, and the next thing I looked around, I thought we had burned the building down, pulled our guns, and the whole nine yards. I mean, state troopers, West Lafayette, the whole street was full of number of police cars. I said, Leroy, maybe you should go outside. But now you'd open your mouth. Now. So the officer came, so the sergeant on duty came in and said, what seemed to be the problem? Well, I got a smart aleck here. He's talking about he's not going. I said, officer, all I want to do is make one phone call. Then if y'all want me to go outside, I'll go. But I want to make one phone call. And so he looked at me and said, okay, make your phone call. I called Coach Mollenkopf. I said, Coach, we are down here at this restaurant, and every police in West Lafayette, in the surrounding areas out here waiting on something. They look like they're going to kill us. He said, tell you what, go back to the table you're sitting at and sit down. I'll be there in 3 minutes. In 3 minutes, Jack Mollenkopf walked in the door with Red Mackey and Fred Hovde. I said, now, this is powerful here, boy. This man.
Fred Hovde's the president, and Red Mackey's the athletic director.
He walked in with two of the most high-profile people on campus. And so he walked in and said, what's the situation? So I told him what happened. He said, officer, these are my football players. I think y'all better leave. All the police cars backed out. He came to me, he sat down, and he said, let me tell you, if I find out that you're lying, I'm going to bury you. I saw his power at that moment.
Yeah.
And if you can get the president to accompany you, I thought maybe he was going to say, well, I'll be there. When he came in with Hovde, Mackey, and Mollenkopf, I said, this man got clout.
That's a good story. That's really
got
something.
Clout. Changed my whole district. I said, Jack, whatever you tell me to do, I'm going to do it.
Amazing. Well, the NFL draft comes along, the 1969 NFL draft, and you are the third player taken, OJ's first, and then a guy named George Koontz
from Notre Dame.
From offensive tackle. Goes second. You're third. Now, again, there's not a big draft deal like there is today. How did you find out that you were the third pick in the draft by the Eagles?
It was the media. I mean, you know, you get a phone call from teams, and back then you didn't have that AFL-NFL war going on. That would
have been a merger.
And so once they said this team drafted, you knew you weren't going to go anywhere else but to that team. And I was kind of – I wasn't distraught or anything, but, you know, with O.J. coming out, I thought – I didn't know Koontz was having such a great season, but you also start looking at what teams needed. Mm-hmm. And when Philadelphia – when I found out I was going to Philadelphia, I was kind of like, do I really want to go to Philadelphia? I didn't know that much about Philadelphia. I knew Tim Brown played up there. I knew Bob Brown from Nebraska was a big offensive tackle. I had heard about Sonny Jurgensen. So you hear about the names, but also you hear about the history, the fans. And, you know, you say, well, I'm not worried about the fans. If I go there and do what I can, I'll be okay. But also I knew the deck was stacked against me going to Philadelphia. They had Tom Wittyshek, who was their premier running back at the time. Then they traded Sonny Jurgensen down to Washington Redskins for Norm Snead. And I went in, and the thing that kind of set me off was I was late signing my contract. My lawyer said, we're not going to sign. We're going to see what – OJ gets. If OJ gets X dollars, then we're going to see if we can get you close to what OJ getting. And back in the days, Joe Namath came out at the same time, said he wanted more money from the Jets. He wanted $400,000. And I know the general managers were going crazy that we're not giving Joe that much. And OJ was trying to hold out for $500,000 with Buffalo. And the Buffalo Bills are saying, well, we're not going to give him that much. And I'm sitting down here not knowing what George Koontz is doing with the Atlanta Falcons. I'm sitting here saying, well, all I want is I want to play ball. And we went to the last week before OJ decided he was going to sign. I had to go up to Chicago, fly to New York, and I met in Pete Rozelle's office with Buddy Young and his staff, and then Leonard Toews was the owner of the Eagles at the time. Well, Jerry Woolman was the owner prior to Leonard Toews buying the team. So I figured, like, hey, it's football. I'm going to go up here. We're going to tell them what we want. My agent was out of Chicago by the name of Arthur Morris, and we went in. Arthur Morris must be about this tall. And Pete Retzlaff was 6'6", about 250. And he was the general manager for the Eagles at the time. He was an offensive end, tight end for the Eagles in during his playing career. And Pete looked at Art Morris and said, if you think we're going to give an untried rookie that kind of money, I'll kill you. And my lawyer kind of started shaking. I said, oh, Lord, this is going to go. So Art tried to throw out the fact, well, we won't sign in there if we're going to go to Canada for a year. And Rozelle set it in the table and said, no, I don't think we're going to have that happen. And so we hammered out this so-called great contract, which to this day I still say it wasn't a great contract, but it was a contract. I flew to Chicago. I went up to Chicago, left my car here. All my clothes, my contact lenses, everything is in my car, ready for me to come back and get and drive to Philadelphia. I signed the contract in the commissioner's office that day. And I said, well, now I'm going to go back out to, I thought I was going to go out to LaGuardia or Kennedy, catch a plane back to Chicago, come down, get my car, come on back to Philadelphia. The owner looked at me and said, you're going to go downstairs, get in the limo that's parked down on Park Avenue. We're going to ride straight down to Reading, Pennsylvania. We're going to have a press conference and football practice start for you. And I'm looking at him like, I looked at my lawyer, he said, you signed the contract. And so I ended up in Reading, Pennsylvania with sunglasses on, a suit, and the underwear I had, and I had to go out and go to a Kmart or somewhere to buy underwear to change into. and wore sweatpants and sunglasses in practice.
Wow.
Because they wouldn't let me
get your stuff.
Get my stuff. And yet they expected you to do the same thing with sunglasses on. I said, I need my contact lenses. And then I realized that this is a business and these people really are staunch. And then I had a coach who, to me, was probably one of the worst coaches I've ever had in any sport I ever participated in, because he just couldn't even look at the players. I mean, he was the type of guy who would stand on the sideline. If you even made a sound or walked past him, he'd jump. So,
how'd you get your stuff? Somebody drive your car out to you?
No, what happened was we played the Giants up in Princeton, New Jersey. Was the annual game between the Giants and the Eagles, a preseason game. And after the game, I was able to go up straight up to New York. I got a friend of mine to take me up to the airport. I got a flight, flew back to Chicago, came down, got my car, and drove back to Philadelphia on that Monday. That was our day off. And I said to myself, I can't believe that they kept my car hostage, but they kept me hostage. During that time period, when you're number one, they perceive you to be a little different than everybody else. Mm-hmm. You got up on the table and you sung your school's fight song and you carried shoulder pads, you carried helmets. So that was part of the ritual. That was no big deal. But then some of the veterans said, well, Leroy, you know, number one, don't drive Pontiacs. Number one, drive Cadillacs. So all the players had their own little thing. And then you start looking at the ambiance and what players do at that level. And you say, wow, you better grow up quick, because this is not college ball anymore.
Yeah.
And so once I found out I was in Philadelphia, I just say, look, you're in Philadelphia. Now you need to find a place to live. You know who your agent is. You know how you want to do this. You know how you want to do that. Don't be the last one to practice. Be the first one to practice every day. At least that shows a sign that you're willing to work. Some nights I didn't even want to go home. I said, I'm going to sleep in my car so I don't have to go home tonight. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be here when they come in the morning. But then when you get up there, you find out that everything up there is about 2 seconds to 3 seconds faster than it's in college. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those holes that look like that doorway over there all of a sudden turned into a little swivel door. If you don't hit it now, you won't see it. And guys will let you know if you can play. Mm-hmm. And I thought, they say, hey, man, keep up the good work. You're doing great, young man. But yet, if your management don't let you play and do your thing, it doesn't matter what the guys on the other team are saying. They're going to always try to be encouraging, because that's the way it is. It's a brotherhood.
Yeah.
But yet, then when you start listening to the fans in Philadelphia, you say, boy, they don't care if you die on the field. They probably either they're going to do two things. If you die and they like you, they're going to cheer for you. If you die and they don't like you, they're going to boo you. They'll turn on you in a minute. We played the Dallas Cowboys, and Calvin Hill was their star running back at the time. They had, I think Roger Staubach might have been the quarterback. And they ran a sweep. And I came up to turn the play in, and Reggie Rucker, their wide receiver, came in and blocked me in a crab block, and I'm trying to get him off. Well, they got two all-pro guards pulling at the same time. And I'm trying to get this guy off me, and I'm trying to keep my eye on these two pulling guards, because I ain't worried about Calvin Hill. I'm worried about these two guys. Look like two trains coming down down the middle of the track. And by the time I got Reggie out of my knee and I did like this, they just buckled me over. I mean, birds were flying around, little blue, yellow birds. I'm like, oh, my God. And the fans start cheering because I was hurt. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. So now I'm going to try to make the hero play. I'm going to go up and bust Calvin the next time, because I go on the sideline, they give me smelling salt and the whole 9 yards, I'm back on the field. Well, in the secondary of that year, we had Bill Bradley from Texas. We got Nate Ramsey, who went to Indiana, and we had Al Nelson from Cincinnati. We had a starting defense secondary, and they didn't move into defense. But now I get steamrolled. I make a tackle. I go up to make a tackle, and the field is saturated with water. Got on these little cleats like this, and my cleats give out, and I miss the tackle. Calvin Hill goes down the field for about 15 more yards. Man, they rain down. And so now all of a sudden, if I go back to Philadelphia, they say, well, you know, Philadelphia made a mistake in drafting Leroy Keyes. They should have taken O.J. I wish they had taken O.J. too, because I really didn't want to come to the city. But, hey, I'm here. And I said, you know, I didn't have a bad career. But the bottom line is when I blew out my Achilles tendon twice, I knew it was going to be hard.
Yeah.
Trying to do the things I wanted to do. In my mind, I don't want to tear out my Achilles tendon a third time. So I stayed on defense for 3 more years in Philadelphia. And I was the second leading interceptor in the secondary. And, you know, I didn't make All-Pro. Bill Bradley was back there. We covered for him, but he made all the mistakes. So we made all the passes go to him. And I thought I had some good games, some bad games. But it was what it was. And I look back at that time in my life as I told myself I want to be in the NFL for 10 years. But it turned out to be 5. And then I had two Achilles tendon injuries. And I had torn up my, then in Kansas City, when I went to Kansas City, I blew up my MCL in Kansas City.
Yeah, you only played like 3 games there, didn't you?
Yeah. And that was, now you're talking about ugly. Now that was a bad experience. Hank Stram was a Purdue guy. And when they traded for me, it was one of those trades where somebody didn't want to go somewhere else. So we're going to negotiate another sweetheart deal with this team so they can get him, and we'll trade somebody from them down to you, and we'll take these two guys. So Ernie Callaway and myself, we were the two guys from Philadelphia to go to Kansas City. Gary Philbin was with the Jets, and he didn't want to play with the Jets anymore, so they sent him to the Eagles, and then they sent somebody else from the Eagles to. And it was crazy. And I get to Kansas City, and we got Mark Livingston, the quarterback. But you got Buck Buchanan, Bobby Bell, Curly Culp, Willie Lanier, Jan Stenerud, Ed Buddy, Jim Tyra, Jim Marcellus, all the Pro Bowl guys. I said, man, I'm a great group of guys. And I get out there, and Ed Podolak from Iowa is the starting running back at the time. And they got Jeff Kinney from Nebraska. They got Cannonball Butler, Ronnie Bly. So we got a long contingency of running backs. And Warren McVay from Houston was also a running back. And they cut Warren McVay, and I make the squad. First home game we're playing, I just normal play. And Hank decided, I'm not going to play tonight. He brought Warren McVay back and said, McVay know the system better, so I'm going to let McVay suit up and I'm going to let you. And I'm going like, I make the team, you bring a guy back that you cut, and he's going to play, and I'm going to sit in the stand. So we get shellacked. And I'm sitting in the press box with Hank's wife. And she turns around to me and she says, Elroy, what's wrong with the team? Now, my name is Leroy, but she calls me Elroy.
Yeah.
And I took offense to it. I said, you sleep with the mother every night. Why don't you ask him what's wrong with the team? And she must have told him, because next day at practice, he called me and he said, I heard you had words with my wife. I said, no, I didn't have words with your wife. Your wife asked me what was wrong with the team. And I told her, she slept with you. You shouldn't tell her what's wrong with the team. I don't know. I'm not playing.
Yeah.
So he suits me up. We play against Pittsburgh, I think, at home, or Cleveland Browns. And he suits me up, and I get to carry the ball 5 times in the game, and I got 69 yards and 5 carries. I feel like, hey, man, I'm rolling tonight. So I come back to the sideline, and he said, okay, I don't see the field the rest of the night. So I got Otis Taylor coming in and said, hey, man, you okay? I said, yeah, I'm fine. He said, how come you ain't playing there? I don't know. I got Curly Cup. Hey, Lee, what's the problem? So everybody on the sideline is asking me, well, how are you playing? But this man ain't put me back in the game. So that's how it went through the whole season. Then we get to go to Buffalo and play the Bills. This is the Monday Night Football game, Howard Cosell and the whole 9 yards. And so they're building this as the first time that Leroy Keyes and OJ would actually be on the offensive side of the ball. Together. They're building this thing up.
Yeah.
And we get up to Rice Stadium, and I'm in the locker room. I got my ankles taped, got my pants on, the whole 9 yards. Hank comes around. I'm standing in the locker room. He comes around the corner and peeks at me and says, I go over. He said, I changed my mind. I'm going to let Kenny play tonight instead of you. I'm standing there like, what? I said, well, he's the coach. What are you going to do? You're going to fight? I said, okay. So I walk back through the locker room, get the thing to cut the ankle, tape off your ankles. And I'm sitting on the table. So Bobby Bell walks over and says, what you doing, man? I said, coach just told me I ain't playing tonight. They said, what? Now all the players again are in shock. But Hank just said, I ain't playing. So I cut the tape off. I go up in the press box in Rich Stadium. They got some of the prettiest young ladies serving drinks that you ever want to see. And I know I ain't playing. And I don't really drink, but I decided that night I'm just going to drink everything they bring to me. And I started drinking everything. And so I get on the team bus, and the coaches sit on the first 2 rows, and the players fall in. And Emmett Thomas got on the bus with me. He said, hey homeboy, he said, How do we look now? I said, man, y'all stunk up the place. And I was saying it so loud. I said, that dumbass coach don't know what he was talking about. And, you know, I just it was the liquor talking now.
Yeah.
But now, Bobby Bailey's across the aisle said, Keys, keep it down, man, the coach ready. I said, I don't give a shit. What are you going to do? Tell me I can't play or kick me off the bus? I just got outlandish.
Yeah.
We get on the plane, we get back, and he called me, and he said, you know, you really showed up last night on the flight home. I said, Coach, I said, Hank, what else do you want to do to me? I said, tell me so I'll know in advance. What else do you want to do to me? I don't know why you traded for me. You won't play me. When you suit me up, you come out and you embarrass me by telling me I ain't going to play, by bringing other players you know I should be playing in front of. I said, so you can't do nothing to me. Unbeknownst to me, the Oakland Raiders had asked to try to trade for me to come to Oakland. Hank voided the trade because he said, I'm not going to have Leroy playing in Oakland playing against me twice during this year. And I'm going like, you got to be kidding me. I didn't know that my agent, Art Morris, was also Hank Stram's agent.
Mm.
So when I called my agent to tell him and complain about getting me out of here, he said, hey, don't worry. You'll be okay there. Hey, Hank paying you much more money than I'm paying you. So yeah. I know where your loyalty was. So Ed Podolak was the one to pull my eyes on that transaction. So the day he cut me, I went in, we were practicing, and I ran a route against Willie Lanier, flared out the backfield. Willie Lanier chased me, and I make the catch, and my cleat catches in the AstroTurf at Arrowhead Stadium. And I heard the pop, pow. I go down like somebody shot me. Not one coach, one trainer, nobody moved. I'm sitting down there on the field. I lay down on the field for about 15 minutes. Nobody is coming to see what's wrong with me. So I drag myself to the goalpost, use the goalpost to pull myself up. Finally, a ball boy come down and said, Coach, want to know what's wrong with you? I said, you go back and tell Coach, I don't know. So he said, ball boy goes back, tell Hank, he doesn't know. Tell the ball boy to come back and say, tell him go in the locker room and talk to the trainer. The trainer's in the locker room, the head trainer. I go in the locker room and I knock on his door and he said, what's up? I said, I can't bend my knee. My knee, it feel like particle of bone is in between my knee and I can't lock out at all. My knee is, I can't bend. He said, take your uniform off, take a shower. We'll look at it after you finish taking your shower. Now, I can't even bend down to take my shoes off. So I take a pair of scissors, I cut the pants straight down the leg, took the shoulder pads, cut them off, step in the shower, come out. Here, take this and go see the doctor. I can't even drive my own car. Well, I say, I got to figure out a way to drive because these folks ain't going to see me help me. I got this leg straight out, try to drive with my right foot on the brake and the gas. I go find the doctor's office because I'm new to Kansas City. I don't know where I'm going. I get to the doctor's office, walk in, and the receptionist said, can I help you? I said, well, I play with the Kansas City Chiefs, and I think I blew out my knee, and I had to come see doctor, whatever his name was. She said, have a seat. I sat down. I sat in that seat for 3.5 hours, and I'm sitting there saying, excuse me, but where's the doctor? Well, he's in surgery right now. Now my knee is throbbing. God, she never asked me, did you want a glass of water? You want to put an ice pack on it? What's wrong? Nobody else in there but this one doctor. So when he finally comes in, he asked me, what's wrong with you? I tell him the same thing. I said, I don't know. He said, okay, come on in the room. I go in the room, take my pants off. I'm sitting on the edge of the table. He clicks the knee. He said, look like a little college. We'd go and snip that out today, and you'd be able to play Sunday. Now, this was a Wednesday. I'm looking at him saying, you got to be kidding me. I said, I can barely walk, man. I said, that's more than a college. He said, I said it's a college. I said, okay. I got off the table, put my clothes on, drove straight to the Kansas City airport, got on the plane, flew to Philadelphia. Now, I had a doctor in Philadelphia named Dr. James Nixon who had done my 2 Achilles tendon surgeries, and I trusted him. I called and said, Dr. Nixon, I'm not asking you to operate on me, but I want you to look at my knee and tell me what you think is wrong. When I went in and he did this, he looked at me and he said, what did the doctor in Kansas City say was wrong with your knee? I said, he said it was just cartilage. He said, Leroy, you done tore out your ACLs and your MCLs in that knee. You got to reconstruct that whole knee. I'm going like, you're kidding me. So I called Kansas City to talk to Hank to tell him what the doctor. He said, well, since you think the doctor in Philadelphia know more than our doctor, why don't you let him do the surgery? This is the attitude. I'm saying, well, damn, I'm worried about my own safety and whether I'm going to play again. So I said, okay. So Doc Nixon operated on my knee. After my surgery's over, I fly back to Kansas City. Hank Stram tells me, well, since you got your surgery done in Philadelphia, why don't you rehab in Philadelphia at their facility? You don't have to worry about rehab. He would not let me in Arrowhead Stadium to rehab and use his medical room. I'm sitting there going like, you got to be getting, this is a guy from Purdue. I flew back to Philadelphia because I had a home in New Jersey at the time, off season. So I called the trainers for the Eagles, and they let me come over, and they work me out every day. Kansas City ain't do nothing. So I go back out in May for a mini camp. Now, my knee's not 100%. I know it's not 100%, but I said, I figure I can still go out here and do what I have to do. Well, before I even got a chance to do what I do, he called me, and the young man said, well, coach wants you to bring your playbook. So I go into his office, and we're sitting there, and now he's telling me all this stuff about Oakland and the whole nine yards. And Leroy, you know, this hurts me that I got to let you go. But we got a couple of young rookies, and we can pay them half of what we're paying you. And I'm going like, you got to be kidding me. I said, but hey, Hank, no problem. No problem. And then he said something that was so outlandish. I said, hey, don't let me come behind this desk and hurt you. So I said, look, let me get out of here. I left everything I had in the locker room. I never even went back in the locker room to take a jersey, a helmet, or nothing. I left everything that Kansas City had in their locker and just said, I went back to my apartment, packed. And when Hank passed, I think Lenny Dawson asked me without going to Hank's funeral. I said, Lenny, I love you, brother, but I wouldn't go to Hank's ramp, you know. If he came to me and asked me to come on bending knees, I could never forgive him because I thought I got a worse deal from this man than I got even from the people in Philadelphia. It was crazy. So those are the kind of stories that you run into and people say, you got to be kidding me. And yet your teammates, they see what you can do. And after I had the surgery, I knew I wasn't going to be running 4.4s anymore because I had lost a step. I had two Achilles tendon injuries. Mm-hmm. I said, hey, playing safety, I'm okay. But the bottom line is I understood that it was all about a business and how much money can we save at the time because it wasn't as lucrative as it is today.
Yeah.
And so I just, when I said that's it, then now she said, well, why don't you try for the USFL? I said, look, I've been to the NFL. I'm not going to the USFL. I'm done. I'm out of kaput.
Yeah.
So it was it. But it was a journey of learning, adjusting from those glory moments in college where you did what you asked to do. The media, the fans, the frenzy that came with it, it was because of what you did there. But then they expect you to have the same kind of success at the next level. And if you don't, either you're a failure or you were the worst this or you're the worst mm-hmm. that. And the bottom line is, I tell everybody, when it's all said and done, if 50,000 people had played in the NFL, I was one of them.
Oh yeah,
and that, regardless of how you feel about me personally, you can't take that away from me. I know I was on a roster. I played 5 years in that league. I know what that league is all about. So, and what I did in college has nothing, because what I did in high school may have been different than what I did in college. So it's all a big tapestry that you had to understand that it's part of the game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was that rookie contract you signed? You mentioned that.
I think it was something like 3 years for $181,000 with 30. 80 was guaranteed, and so my contract was like 30, 33, 36 for 3 years.
So you made a total of like $100,000 or something from the Eagles?
Mm-hmm. That was, you take the $80,000 up top, then you look at 30. 35, that's 85, 65. I think it's $100,000 plus the bonus of $80,000.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, and that was the salary.
Yeah.
And then when I signed with Kansas City for the 2 years I played, the year I played in Kansas City, I made more in Kansas City than I did with the Eagles. I made 55 in Kansas City. And now when you sit there and pick up the paper and see here's a guy who's the 278th player taken in the F draft, and automatically when he walks in the door, he's making $479,000.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I mean, he's the last player. You were the top three, and this is what we got. So if OJ got 300, Coons got maybe 160, I got 180, we were the top three players in the league that year.
Yeah.
Wow. It's crazy.
It is crazy.
But that's the way it was.
One-on-one with Leroy Keyes returns in a moment.
All right, thanks to Leroy Keyes for taking time to share his story.
And he's got a lot to talk about, and he's good at talking about it. So it was difficult to squeeze his story in. I wasn't able to include the part of our conversation about his pro career or his life after football. But his NFL career turned out to be a disappointment because of injuries and being in the wrong places at the wrong time. His versatility actually might have hurt him there because he was never allowed to settle into a position. He was the third pick in the 1969 draft, but signed late with Philadelphia because his agent held him out. He had a respectable rookie season, playing mostly offense, but also some defense. But injuries to his Achilles tendon limited him to 3 games the second season, and then he played defense the next 2 seasons. He did have 6 interceptions in one of those. He was then traded to Kansas City, where he played just 3 games on offense before another injury led to his retirement. He later worked for 17 years as a desegregation specialist in Philadelphia, and then returned to Purdue, first as an assistant coach under Jim Coletto and Joe Taylor, and later with the John Purdue Club before retiring a few years ago. He still lives in West Lafayette and has 2 children from his second marriage who are still in high school in the area. Things didn't quite work out for him in the long run of his football career, but they seem to have worked out nicely in the long run of his life. Now, if you missed part of this conversation or want to hear one of the others in the One-on-One archives, you know where to go. The website at 1070thefan.com. Click on Shows, click on One-on-One, and it's all there for you 24/7. You can reach me by email at mark@1070thefan.com, and I'm available on Facebook and Twitter, with the Twitter handle being none other than @MarkMonteith. I'll be back again next week with yet another spine-tingling conversation with an Indiana sports personality, right here on FM 107.5 and 1070 The Fan.